Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast.
Hello, everyone. My guest for today is Sam Dryman. Sam has lived an interesting life. He got his first passport when he was only 5 weeks old and moved to what is now called the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and at the time was known as Zaire, with his family. He also spent a lot of his childhood in Morocco, and that's one of his many homes. He's lived in China for the last 6 years. During my talk with Sam, we got into a lot of storytelling from various parts of the world, including South America and Antarctica and even North Korea. And before we jump into my talk, I should let you know that my book, 1,000 Days Between, is currently available on Amazon, and I go into a lot of great detail with my storytelling in the book about some of these very places that we talk about today. So thanks for checking it out. Thanks for telling a friend about it. And right now, let's get right into my talk with Sam Dryman. How long have you been coming to China or living in China?
So I've been in China coming up on 6 years. I think my official date when I left America and moved here was January 19th, 2011.
Okay.
And I've been in Beijing ever since, pretty much then.
2011 was 6 years ago. Yeah, that's right.
And I know.
Almost.
The date doesn't sound that far away because it's still in the 2010s.
Yeah.
But if you think we're almost 2017, it's actually, that accumulates to 6 years of time.
Yeah.
So
you are correct.
Yeah.
So why did you come here?
Well, why did I come here? I had studied abroad in Hong Kong in college, and that was the first time I had been to East Asia, really. I had grown up overseas and traveled all around different parts of the world, and I wanted to study abroad when I was in school, and I was trying to figure out where, and the one part of the world I had really never been to was East Asia. So my university had a really strong program and relationship with the university in Hong Kong. So it was really easy for me to go there and take classes and not worry about credit transfers or anything like that.
What was your university?
University of Virginia.
Okay.
In the East Coast.
Oh, so you're on the East Coast.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I went to Hong Kong and absolutely fell in love with China. And this was in the spring of 2008. So it was the build-up to the Olympics. It was much China's year. You know, every piece of news was focused on China, whether it was the Olympics or the Olympic torch going around the world and all these Free Tibet riots happening in different cities, or the earthquake, you know, in Sichuan that happened.
That's right. That was that year, too.
It was, yeah. It was a big year to be in China. And so I sort of got swept up in the frenzy of it and traveled all around China while I was studying in Hong Kong. Fell in love with it and realized I wanted to keep pursuing China just in some way. I didn't know what form that would take, but I wanted to be involved with China. Mm. And by the time I went back to school after Hong Kong, I was doing a combined bachelor's and master's program. So I didn't really have time to pursue it academically. I couldn't take Chinese classes. I couldn't take, you know, politics or econ, anything related to China, because I was so busy doing my bachelor's and master's at the same time. So
how does that work? Same time.
It was a special program at my university where you could a normal 2 year master's program. You would do the first year while you're doing your last year of undergrad.
So it's double the work then, basically.
Yeah, but you save a year of time.
Yeah. Wow, that must be like, you must have been crazy. So busy.
It was a busy time, but that's why I wasn't really able to do anything China related in school. So when I graduated, I knew I wanted to stay focused on China. And I ended up working at a think tank in D.C., focusing on China research and stuff like that. And through that, I had made some connections to people that had experience in China. And I started looking at opportunities in China. And the first one I found was in Beijing at the American Chamber of Commerce. So I bought a one-way ticket and came out here and decided to, you know, spend some significant time here and see where life would take me. And it's 6 years later.
That's awesome. Yeah. So, but it was your first time in Beijing then in 2011, or was it before the Olympics?
Before, it was 2008. I had visited Beijing, you know, but never lived in mainland. My only living experience was in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So before I moved here, the most amount of time I had spent in Beijing was 3 days.
Okay.
So that's it.
Yeah.
But I knew I wanted to be part of China. Beijing fit me personality-wise because I was very interested and still am interested, you know, in politics and policy, which Beijing is the center of.
Yeah, so, being the capital.
Exactly. Yeah. So it made sense for me for my interests and what I wanted to get out of China to be based in Beijing. Mm. And so I just decided to move here with this opportunity I had.
That's cool. So, yeah, you had, like, I guess 3 days more than me for pre-Olympics experience.
You hadn't been to Beijing beforehand?
Not until 2014. And people I meet here who have been here a long time, mm-hmm. they almost, like, split Beijing into, like, two eras, like, before the Olympics and after. Because it's just, like, everything changed.
Yeah, I know. I kind of wish I had seen Beijing pre-Olympics, but you know, it's still changing even
constantly.
Yeah.
Although I don't notice it as much around my area, like within the second ring.
Sure.
But yeah, God, it's the suburbs. And it's just crazy how fast things are getting built.
Yeah. Or even in like the fourth ring, between third and fourth ring road in the city,
things are
growing, subway lines. You know, buildings, residential complexes.
That's true. There's been a skyscraper going up around the central business area.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I've kind of been watching from my window.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Every day it's like another story taller.
Yeah.
Every time I go through Wangjing, it's like, it looks different.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And even out like where my wife Katie and I lived our first year in Hoshiyu, it's just 2 years ago. It looks totally different now. There's this giant shopping mall, and it's just... you might as well not even be in China out there.
Yeah. That's
just
China.
Super just modern. It's
growing,
like,
at a rapid pace, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, even today it is. Hmm. So when you were in Hong Kong, were you studying the language at all? Or was it more just studying for your school?
I was taking Chinese, but it was the most basic Chinese you could possibly imagine. First of all, you know, in Hong Kong they speak Cantonese, not Mandarin. But I was taking Mandarin. Mm. So it wasn't useful on a street level basis because no one spoke it on the street. On top of that, it was only 2 days a week. It wasn't even every day.
So
2 days a week, you're only getting so much out of it.
Yeah, it's hard to learn.
It's hard to learn. And there was no characters. It was strictly pinyin and practicing speaking.
Okay.
So it was the most basic form of a class you could possibly take. But that being said, it actually prompted me to take an intro level class in my spare time at school, even during my master's program, and that gave me a foundational level, which is still super basic. I mean, you know, one semester of Chinese is like nothing. You're just learning the most basic words, basic sentence structures and stuff. But it was enough to at least make me feel comfortable moving to Beijing and having a baseline to work off of. So then I could I lived with Chinese people as roommates, I worked with Chinese colleagues, and had a tutor, and sort of all those forces helped me continue, you know, growing.
Yeah, that's super helpful when you can speak it just in your normal life every day.
Right.
The guy I had on before you in this podcast, Patty, he's only been in China for like a year and a half, and he's already pretty fluent in the language. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
I think a large part of that, well, a large part of it's him. I think he's got...
I was going to say, some people are just very talented.
He's just very talented. Yeah. But a lot of it is he just uses it daily.
Yeah.
And just in his job and, like, always is trying to work on it.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you have to have extreme discipline in every day. You can't just be doing it, you know, when you're you know, with a tutor and then forgetting about it. You've got to be pretty rigid.
I know. Yeah. I've had these thoughts like, man, I need to move to a village for a month and just like, where no one speaks English, and then I'll come out like speaking perfect
Mandarin. Right. Yeah. I think that sort of method helps certain people, but other people, I think then it just becomes too overwhelming, and then there's no outlet to even use, like to take a break from Chinese, because it's taxing on your brain
just
constantly be, you know, trying to think of how to say things or you know, the right words or whatever in another language. It's extremely, you know, intensive.
It's totally true. Yeah. Anytime I study it, even now, like for half an hour, more than half an hour, let's say, I'm just like exhausted afterwards. Yeah. I just can't even do anything.
Yeah.
Just like sit there and veg out for an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess that's how you learn.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. You got to put in, there's no shortcut. You just got to put in the man hours to do it. Yeah.
And it's a tough language. I mean, well, in a lot of ways, it's tough. The grammar's not so bad.
Grammar's not so bad, but. You know, characters,
For sure.
And yeah, tones, of course.
But super satisfying. Like I don't know a ton of characters, but I know a lot of food characters. That's just what I decided to learn because it's like the most
helpful.
Practical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause here you walk into, if you walk into like a decent, like mid range restaurant or above, they're going to have English or at least pictures of the food.
Sure.
But if you go into the, like the down and dirty, like local places where it's like super like, $2 for a meal.
Right.
Those
just a laminated piece of paper and Chinese characters, that's it.
Just the characters. Or sometimes they'll just put their whole menu on the wall.
Right.
So they don't even have to hand out pieces of paper.
Right.
It's only characters. No pictures, no guide at all.
Nope, yeah.
And Katie and I, when we first moved here, I would just like point at the some of the items.
Sure, point. Whatever. Yeah, point and shoot sort of.
Yeah, method. Point and pray, I guess.
Right, yeah.
But we got intestines too many times for my liking.
Gosh.
So I quickly learned what that one was.
Yeah.
And how to avoid it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the innards either.
Yeah, they eat a lot of that stuff here.
Yeah.
So you were telling me before now, you just mentioned like you had been like all over the world, other than Asia, even before college.
Actually, when I was born, I guess my travel story starts from when I was 5 weeks old. I got my first passport. My parents were living in Central Africa when I was born. My family's from LA, so when my mom was pregnant and was about to, you know, give birth, she went back to LA where family and, you know, a little bit better hospitals are located. And then I was born in Los Angeles, but my folks were living in Central Africa in what now is known as the Democratic Republic of Congo, but at the time was called Zaire.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in Kinshasa. And so my first passport was when I was 5 weeks old, and my parents moved me back with them to Kinshasa. And that's where I spent the first couple years of my life as a, you know, an infant.
Wow.
After that, my parents went back to the U.S., to the East Coast, where my father's company was. But then, shortly later, we moved to Morocco. And that's where I grew up for almost my entire childhood.
Hmm.
And so when we were there, you know, we would travel all around the country from the desert to the Atlas Mountains to the Atlantic and Mediterranean coasts. We would even take road trips to the Algerian border. We took road trips through Gibraltar and into Spain.
Road trips or a boat trip?
Both. Put the car on a ferry
and then
across the Strait of Gibraltar and then drive through Spain. So my whole travel, it's sort of like in my genes almost, because my folks have been all over the world. My grandmother's been to all seven continents, and she, you know, so sort of traveling has been like a sort of a pastime in the family, just that's gone through the generations of my family.
So you've never had to like justify to your parents why you want to travel then, huh?
No, in fact, they were super encouraging and supportive of the fact that I wanted to, you know, live in this foreign country where I knew no friends, had no family didn't have much experience, but just wanted to go for it. Mm-hmm. And they're great and supportive, and they sort of had the same experience when they were our age. They lived, first my mother actually hitchhiked from the northernmost point in Africa to the southernmost point in Africa. Whoa. So when she went from Tunisia to Cape Town over the course of a year, and then met up with my father in between there. And then they eventually ended up living in Paris, because that was their dream, to live in Paris in the early 80s. And then they eventually made their way back to Africa for the, you know, his work and stuff. So
what was your father doing?
He was working in international development. So his company did all sorts of development related projects, like, you know, water, agriculture, education, women empowerment, you know, small business development, rule of law training, all sorts of different stuff for third world countries around the world. His company was contracting work for USAID, which is within the State Department. It's the International Development Agency in the State Department that's tasked with, you know, foreign development aid. And so his company did all these contract work for them. And so he was running projects, you know, mostly in Africa, and then moved back to the U.S. Once my sister and I got old enough to, where we should be in the U.S. for education purposes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you did go back to school in the U.S.?
So I went to a couple years of middle school and then all of high school in Virginia.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, in Northern Virginia.
Ah, you've moved around a lot.
Yeah. Well, I guess when you like sound off the bat, it sounds that way. But most of it were pretty long stints. I mean, we were in Morocco for 7 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it wasn't like an army brat style where it's 2 years, 2 years, or three, something like that. It was long stretches of time. But yeah, I mean, so my whole childhood was basically in Africa. And then afterwards, I had done some trips through the Middle East and Central and South America. And so the one place I hadn't been to was East Asia. So I decided to venture off into there. And that's came to China. Yeah.
And now you're in China.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, now let's stay with Africa for a minute. Like,
sure.
Africa is the only continent I haven't been to. I've been to the other six.
Mm-hmm. You've been to Antarctica.
Yeah. Yeah.
How'd you get there?
Let's see. That was about 10 years ago. I traveled for like 2.5 years through South America.
Oh, so you went through Patagonia?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a city called Ushuaia at the very bottom of Argentina. Mm-hmm. It's they call it the southernmost city in the world. There's a couple other like smaller places south of there, whatever. So, but it's like 100,000 people still, so it's decent size.
Yeah.
It's at the very, very bottom of the continent. And that's where most of the cruise ships leave from that go to Antarctica. And if you're not going on a cruise, I mean, you could go as a scientist, but it's a little more difficult to get there otherwise.
Yeah.
The cruises that go there are, like, really expensive, mm-hmm. but they do give out last-minute deals sometimes. So I went down there with some friends, and, like, we just checked every travel agency for a couple days. Mm-hmm. There's maybe 10 of them in town. And then eventually we just found one that said, like, 2 weeks to Antarctica and the Falkland Islands for $1,000. So we signed,
how much is that right away?
$9,000 for my cabin. Yeah, yeah. That's the brochure price.
$9,000
US.
And you got it for one.
Yeah.
Holy
cow. It is possible. We had to wait like a week.
But that was 10 years ago. Is that still possible?
That's true. I don't know. I haven't looked at it lately. Maybe we'll get some comments.
Yeah.
More recent times.
That's so funny.
I mean, there's some restrictions that limit the number of people who can go anyway. Yeah. Like, so every country that does any sort of business, whatever, in Antarctica has signed the treaty, Antarctic Treaty, mm-hmm. which I think it still has like maybe 20 years left on it. It was like a 50-year treaty. Mm-hmm. And one thing is there's no military allowed, like mm-hmm. no drilling for oil. And then there's restrictions on tourism too. Mm-hmm. And so the ship that we took had a capacity of like 700, I think, but the limit is 500. So we only had 500.
Got it.
And you can only take 100 people ashore at a time. Mm-hmm. So, and yeah, I mean, they did a really good job of, like, protecting wildlife.
100 people, you mean on the actual land? You mean from the boat
from the to boat, from the boat Chisholm, to the land.
To the land, got it.
So they would, it was a little bit rushed. It's the only way to really do it with that big of a ship.
Right.
Where we'd pull up to, like, wherever we're going for the day. Mm-hmm. And start unloading people early and go in five waves of 100 people each.
Yeah,
and walk around for like an hour and a half on the land and see penguins, sure. See the seals, all the there's so much wildlife on the peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just like really a trip of a lifetime.
Yeah,
the only time I've done a cruise too, so it's like
probably the most worthwhile cruise to do too. Yeah,
it's awesome. The interesting thing is. Most people cannot afford $9,000, whatever they're paying for the rooms and up.
Right. I mean,
those are the cheaper rooms.
Right.
So the clientele on the ship tended to be pretty well off.
Sure.
But then they must have gotten like a big cancellation because there were probably like 50 or so backpackers on board. And these are like the filthy, scummy people.
Sure. Most budget travelers there are. Yeah.
Mixed in with all these people who tended to be retired and have a lot of money.
Right.
Eating like lobster and filet mignon and stuff.
It's awesome.
Interesting mixture.
Yeah. It's good for you.
I met a lot of characters on that ship though. So it was really, really awesome if you got the time to wait it out.
Yeah. So now you want to go to Africa. You got to go to Africa now.
Yeah, that's the last stop.
The last frontier. The final frontier.
Yeah, the final frontier. How many countries have you been to in Africa?
Quite a bit. I mean, I think there are 53 or 54 countries in Africa.
So many.
I've probably been to 10, I think.
Okay, yep.
I mean, I haven't been to much of West Africa. Mm-hmm. Or East Africa, for that matter. It's mostly been north, and then in right before we left, my folks took my whole family on a big safari in the south, and we hit a ton of countries, like, you know, South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and maybe one or two more I'm leaving off. But so mostly in the south, and then North Africa. But not much of places like, you know, Senegal or Ghana or East, like, you know, Uganda or Tanzania. I haven't been to
Ethiopia.
Those. Yeah, no, yeah. Not yet.
Huh.
But
what's your favorite?
Well, I mean, Morocco is like home.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Okay.
So it's hard to not list that. And that's just a pretty amazing country, even if I hadn't lived there. But in terms of just like raw nature, Namibia and Botswana are just unbelievable destinations.
Yeah,
it's so remote. It's so everything's so well protected that it's unlike any. I mean, I was 12 when we went or something like that. So. Okay. It wasn't backpacking, like, you know, I was with parents, and we were in hotels, mm-hmm. in nice places.
But you were old enough to remember it all.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So are there like just giant wildlife reserves? Are they government owned? Are they like private, or do you know that?
I would imagine they're private, mm-hmm. but, you know, they probably pay heavy national park fees or taxes or something like that to the government to protect them. But other parts, I'm sure, are actual government parks. But it's very well regulated, you know, in terms of how you can enter, you know, where the vehicles, you know, where they drive and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's not like you can just rent a car and then just start driving out in the middle of the bush. At least, maybe in some parts you might probably would be able to, but if you want to, I'm sure most of the real heavy wildlife is, you know, on either government protected or privately owned land that's well protected and you know, like well preserved. But again, it's been a long time since I've been there, so if you're listening, You should probably look up this information on yourself.
Yeah, I know. Everything just gets outdated so fast, especially in the developing world.
Right,
like,
right.
Who knows?
Right. But I'm actually going back to South Africa in February.
Yeah.
We have friends, family friends of ours, when we were living in Zaire, there was another family. They were Irish Jews. Their father was running the Heineken factory in, or a Carlsberg factory, well, some beer factory in Zaire, I think. It was a long time ago. And then, anyway, they had kids that were mine and my sister's age, and their youngest son is my age and our age, and he's getting married in South Africa in February.
Cool.
We're going, my girlfriend and I are going to go there, and we're going to rent a car and drive across South Africa and make our way to the wedding.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. What cities are they in?
So the wedding is actually going to be at a game park. That's 4 hours away from Cape Town, but they rented out this game park for the wedding.
The whole park?
Apparently. I'm not sure what it's going to look like, but the wedding itinerary includes two game drives, like safari game drives through the park.
Wow.
And
that's awesome.
Yeah, and we're in bungalows in the park. I don't know what... Excuse me. I have no idea what it'll look like, but that's where the wedding will be, which is awesome. And then my girlfriend and I are going to fly into Johannesburg, and then we are going to drive either from there or from maybe Port Elizabeth, which is on the coast, and then drive across to Cape Town. That's the plan.
That's great.
The plan, yeah.
Wow. So they're going to be like saying their vows, and there's giraffes behind them.
Exactly.
Galloping by.
I think that's what's going to happen. Yeah. We'll see. But I'm excited to go. The point is, I'm excited to go back and sort of reconnect, because since I got the China bug, I've just been focused on Asia.
Just traveling around,
you know, all of East Asia and Southeast Asia. Yeah. I haven't really been back to Africa at all.
Huh.
Even though that's where like my whole early life takes place.
Yeah, it'll be cool, like, for you to kind of check it out as an adult and like just see what you remember, if it's the same or different.
Yeah.
It's always interesting going back somewhere like years or decades later.
Yeah.
Like, you've changed, the place has changed. Everything's changed.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder about some of the places I've been, what they look like now.
Oh, I bet they don't look, I mean, I don't know.
What a do lot you of think? It's probably the same, you know. But I mean, I don't know. Like, I kind of keep up with some of the news from South America because I've been there so long, or I had been there for so long. Venezuela is just really messed up now, you know, and I've met a few people who are from there, who have traveled there recently, and they just got all kinds of stories that seem maybe a little familiar for, like, from my time there, but taken up like 10 notches from like the exchange rate, the money just going crazy, and everybody wants dollars, and everybody's expecting the president to get overthrown any moment, you know.
So have you been to every South American country?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, there's only 13. It's not Africa.
Sure, it's not Africa. But there's, you know, Suriname and...
Like, yeah, yeah.
Small French Guiana.
Yeah, I spent a couple months in those countries.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Guyana was awesome. It was like... I traveled from... I went up in Venezuela to climb Roraima, which is this mountain that's at Tipui. It's like a... That's their name for it. It's a flat, like, tabletop mountain.
Oh.
And it's like...
I think, you know, have you seen the animated movie Up?
Yeah. No, I haven't seen the movie, but...
But there's a scene, it's like based on a mountain in Venezuela.
It is based on Roraima.
So you climb that mountain?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, it is unbelievable.
Must be unbelievable, yeah.
Because at the bottom, it's just like, you're in the tropics.
Right.
It's so hot, it's just... tropical plain where there's like no
escape. But you can actually get on top of this tabletop mountain?
Yeah, that's probably the only one out of maybe 50 in the region that are doable, relatively doable. It's still a strenuous
hike. Is it a multi-day hike, or you can do it in one day?
You can do it in one day. Well, you got to start from this village. That's as far as the roads go. And it takes maybe a day to walk up to the base of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And then how long did it take? Maybe 4 hours, 5 hours to go up it? Maybe more, but I think I want to say it's like 3,000 meters above the
Wow.
Up, right?
Yeah. A vertical climb.
Yeah. I think it's that high.
Then it's probably a longer
although that hike. Might be above sea level, 3,000 meters, but I forget. But it's a long hike.
Sure.
It's a strenuous hike, but it's doable without ropes or anything.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I think that's the only tapua you can just climb without a rope.
Mm-hmm.
Which, so it's like, there's like a whole different ecosystem on top.
Right, of course.
And so there's a lot of these tapuis, like the land has eroded around them,
mm-hmm.
like 100 million years ago or something it started.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tapuis are all that's left. Like that entire part of Venezuela used to be just flat. And now there's not everything else eroded, and there's just these mountains left.
Hmm.
And all the wildlife just got like trapped on top of these mountains over time and evolved separately on each one. So each one has its own unique ecosystem. It's like the Galapagos Islands.
Right. It's wild.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Wild. Yeah.
And there's one of these tapuis has these sinkholes in it that are like 1,000 feet or 1,000 meters deep, I forget, but
1,000 meters would be like, that'd be huge.
That'd be crazy. Yeah, maybe it's just 1,000 feet. Maybe I'm getting feet and meters screwed up. But these giant sinkholes
for sure,
in it.
It's a sinkhole, yeah.
Yeah, and
that's crazy.
At the bottom, there's a forest, and it's got its own unique ecosystem.
Wow.
At the bottom of the sinkhole. And this is so like unexplored. So I'm really into this stuff. Like, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle,
mm-hmm.
the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
He also wrote a book called The Lost World, and that's about which later became a movie, I guess, the dinosaur movie.
Right.
But the book The Lost World is about an explorer in the late 19th century who goes to one of these mountains, like Roraima, and finds dinosaurs still living on top.
Okay.
And you go up this thing, and you expect to see a dinosaur around any corner. It's just...
Cool.
It's really wild.
Cool, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I went up there, and... Then back into Brazil for a bit, and then into Guyana,
mm-hmm.
and traveled for like a month through Guyana.
I've heard my dad's done work in Guyana. He said it's just beautiful.
Oh, yeah, he totally said, beautiful.
Really beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Georgetown's a pretty shitty city. Like, it's got a lot of crime. It's like,
right.
You know, not...
Third world capital city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the most pleasant place.
Right.
But you go inland, and it's just amazing.
Yeah.
Just the jungle there is just so, it's so well preserved, really. It's
the only places in South America I've been are Peru and Bolivia.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. But yeah, both those countries were stunners.
Yeah.
Loved them. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Where'd you go in Bolivia?
Bolivia, I crossed over from Peru from Lake Titicaca.
Mm-hmm.
So. I was on the Peruvian side, then I went into Bolivia, and then spent some time in Lake Titicaca on the Bolivian side, and then went to La Paz, and from there, I did, like, the Road of Death. And that was an intense, intense bike ride. Did you do that?
Yeah, I did. You want to explain it, though?
Sure. So, yeah, this is... You know, called the Road of Death because it's allegedly the most dangerous road in the world. I think it averages a car accident every 2 weeks. At least that was the statistic that I remember reading when I was doing that. And the, the thing everyone does is you ride a bicycle from the top down. At least that's what I did.
Yeah.
So, you're fashioned with a bicycle. And a helmet, and, you know, I don't even remember if we had knee pads. I think we did. But, you know, you're told how to ride, you know, you actually stay on the outside. You don't stay on the inside because the inside will have cars coming up. And when you're going around curves, you don't want to be running into them. But obviously, you know, you watch your speed, you stay on the outside, but I think we started, going down some relatively smooth paved roads, and then you start getting onto really gravelly, rocky sections, but you're just surrounded by coca leaf plantations and, you know, jungle, and it's gorgeous. But I remember stopping, like, our guide stopped us at one point, and we looked over the edge, and these aren't gradient, you know, declines. It's a cliff, you know, like thousands of foot cliff drop to the bottom of the crevice of the mountain that you're sort of traversing through. and that the bottom of this, at this one point, you could, we could clearly see a van had just like fallen over on its side.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know,
it's all too common.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so we, you know, I was with a group, and we were all going down. And actually, I was with a big company, and the company had, you know, separate groups. You know, there were maybe three or four groups of different people, and we would take breaks at different times and stagger ourselves so it wasn't just a big line of 30 people riding a bike. Anyway, at one point, my guide hears some static on his radio from another guide, and he tells everyone, "All right, it's time to get on your bike. We gotta move." And we get down to where another group is further down the road, and it turns out one of the other tourists on a bike had ridden on the inside lane close to the cliff instead of on the outside, and she ran head on into a side view mirror of a car.
Oh no.
And you could see glass everywhere. Her bike was totally bent, you know, her face was bloodied up. She, you know, it was just lying there, and it was such a bad scene, but it's just like sort
she
of
got clotheslined. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was just like sort of these terrifying, like, accidents that you know, can easily happen if you're not 100% focused or paying attention to the road and, you know, riding.
Yeah, and it's so easy in that situation to go like, "Oh shit, this cliff is like 1,000 feet high.
Exactly.
I'm not going to ride near it.
Exactly.
I'm going to go in."
Right.
But that's actually more dangerous.
Exactly.
Than...
Exactly. So, yeah, that was a sobering experience, and I just remember, you know, I think this was also like it took like 7 or 8 hours to do the whole thing, but it was a 3,000 meter drop from where we started to the bottom, and I remember afterwards I couldn't feel my hands because I had been riding the brakes so much going down, and they were almost cramping because of just how tight I was holding the handlebars and the brakes. It was so intense.
Yeah. It's a wild ride.
Right? Yeah.
It's just quite a rush.
Yeah. Mm. But I didn't tell my parents I did that until after.
Yeah, that's one of those you gotta wait.
Right.
it's never, "Mom, I'm going to do this."
Right.
It's, "Mom,
guess what I just did."
Yeah, and I'm okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Katie and I made that, well, I guess you could say mistake this year. We went to North Korea and... and like told our parents about it beforehand. Yeah, and it's like, and then that guy got held, and he's still in custody.
Yeah, you know, he's went to my university.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Oh man.
So that was all over, you know, the news feed and the back and forth with people in my school and stuff like that.
Wow. So a lot of people knew him then.
I mean, I think it was just, you know, a big deal because he was a college student who was at the school that I went to, and but it was, you know, dumb. Like,
yeah, very dumb.
Yeah,
but like that, we were all like, Katie and I were freaking out beforehand because.
So when did you go?
For Chinese New Year this year.
Okay,
so what was that?
February?
Yeah, early February.
Okay.
But like 2 or 3 weeks beforehand.
Yeah,
Katie was just like reading the news online.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, like, a guy held in, American guy held in North Korea. She clicked on the story. She's like, "Huh, we're going to North Korea." Huh?
She's like, this is where we're going to be.
Yeah. And the story said, like, he was traveling with Young Pioneer Tours. And we're like, wait a minute, we're going with Young Pioneer Tours.
Oh, and, man. I mean, you also read about why he got taken.
Not at the time. Oh. It wasn't announced what happened until like after we had gotten back. And so we had a meeting with our guides who were going to take us, and one is this Australian guy and then one is an Irish guy, and they took our whole group in Beijing, and they said, I mean, they told us a few different things about what to expect, but then they said, yeah, like, elephant in the room, this guy's like being held, and they just said at the time, like, well, we can't tell you what he did, but he did something. He wasn't just kidnapped for no reason. And that kind of settled our nerves a little bit because we didn't know.
Right.
We thought it might have been for no reason. Then they said, like, look, once you hear what he did, which you will hear eventually, like, you'll just go, oh, yeah.
Right. Like, yeah. You'll realize, right. Don't be stupid. Right. And then everything should be okay.
It's not like he just looked the wrong way and, right. like, got kidnapped.
Right.
It was, you know, he actually, well, for people who don't know the story, he, like, tried to steal a sign in, the, yeah. in this hotel.
The hotel, yeah.
And it was kind of a big insult and...
Yeah, well, and I think it was New Year's Day or New Year's Eve or something, and he yeah. was drunk.
Yeah, like, you know, 4 in the morning.
Yeah, it wasn't the smartest thing to do, and, you know, there's really no excuse for it. If you go into this country
yeah.
with your eyes wide open, you yeah. know, just, you don't want to ruffle any feathers or make any silly mistakes, because you don't know what can happen.
Right.
And now yeah. he's in, you know, 15 years of hard labor.
Yeah.
It's kind of shitty.
Yeah, I mean, I hope he gets out earlier.
Yeah.
I don't think he deserves that kind of punishment, but it's...
No, you know, but at the same time... No, of course not.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, it's nobody's fault but his.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I'll say, like, our whole group was, like, on edge for the first couple of days. Mm-hmm. We're like, oh shit, can we say anything here?
Right.
Can we drink?
Yeah, so, I mean, what was it like going there? How do you describe
really,
it?
It was just bizarre. I mean, I remember the first, like, when we got to the airport in Beijing, we just saw, like, a normal sign, and like, for your flight's leaving for Pyongyang. And it looked like any other...
What airline?
Koryo? Okay. Koryo Airlines? I think it's the only one.
Sure.
It's this kind of famous airline for being pretty shitty, but...
Yeah.
We saw a bunch of guys wearing the pin, you know, the pin with the leader's heads on.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, those are North Koreans.
Right.
I'm like, you know, this is for real.
Right.
And they all had these boxes of, like, 20 boxes of stuff that mm-hmm. they had acquired in Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
And these must have been, like, really high-level officials to be able to leave the country. And they were flying back home. And they, I guess the story is they just buy all kinds of crap.
I'm sure they bring a ton of goods from China, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah.
And then their wives will sell them or whatever when they're out traveling, make some extra money. But then, we boarded the plane. It was like any other flight. Like, but then once we got on and all the employees had the pin again, and then as soon as we sat down, I was like, I smell cigarettes. Someone's smoking on the plane. Like,
really?
Yeah, it's like immediately back in time, like 40 years.
Yeah, wow.
I'm like, what the hell? Someone's smoking. And then,
that's amazing.
Yeah, and then it really, really hit me when we flew over the city of Pyongyang and saw the pyramid and like the famous hotel. That's
yeah,
a,
yeah.
A giant pyramid.
Right.
Like, oh my God, we're in Pyongyang. What the hell am I doing?
Yeah, you crossed the,
yeah.
the point of no return.
Yeah, we're in. We're in for good. Yeah. I'm like, oh boy.
And is your passport stamped with a North Korean stamp?
No, they don't give stamps there for in your passport. They
so just, what, stamp a piece of paper?
Yeah, they just stamp a piece of paper. That's terrifying too, because you have to turn in your passport when you get there. And you don't get it back till you leave. And so if they're going to hold you, they've got your passport.
You're fucked, yeah.
Yeah, you're totally fucked. So, you know, there's always that little thought like, what happens?
Yeah, what and, happens now?
Yeah. And the way they held this other guy earlier this year. I mean, he was like in the airport.
Yeah.
And
to board the plane.
Yeah. And they made sure they manipulated it so that he was going to be the last one.
Yeah.
So his whole tour group, his guides, they're all
on the plane already. Yeah.
And they're like, well, we're holding on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they said he was sick or something. They're taking him to the hospital.
Yeah.
So something seems wrong.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the tour, like, you have to do a tour.
Sure, yeah.
And you're allowed to go. Like,
yeah.
They don't mind you going. And the people were unbelievably nice and, like, really accommodating. But the tour was, like, half of it was, like, oh, yeah, this just seems like a normal country. And then, like, something would happen where I'd go, oh, that's right. I, like, kind of snap out of it. Mm-hmm. Like, they're almost, like, putting you into a trance or something to make
right.
it look like
sure.
normal. I mean,
yeah.
we knew that was going to happen.
Of course. Right?
We knew it'd be a lot of propaganda. But that's kind of like, Katie and I are both kind of nuts about the country and seeing this like last kind of stronghold of this communist world that
yeah.
doesn't really exist anymore outside.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'd get little peeks at it. Like, for example, every single time we ate in a restaurant, the power would go out. Like, we'd have this like really nice big like buffet, and I know we're eating like 10 times more food than anyone else gets, and
sure,
it's just like really amazing. But then the power would go out and everybody just kind of keep on eating, and like nothing happened. Like at first we were like, what's going on? But we just got used to it.
Could you leave your hotel at any, like let's say at night, couldn't you leave your hotel and walk around? You cannot, right?
No. I mean, I've been told like a few people have done that, and they don't get in serious trouble. They just like say, now you shouldn't be leaving. But
that's kind of thing where you like could easily then get arrested and like held back.
Yes. In fact, that we were kind of like making bets. What did this guy do? And that our money was on that.
Uh-huh.
And the river was frozen, like right behind the hotel.
Uh-huh.
The hotel, I should explain, the hotel that you stay in, it's the biggest hotel I've ever seen. It's like 45 stories tall.
Yeah.
It's giant, this huge building.
Right.
And it's on an island.
Right.
And so there's only one road in and one road out. But the river all around it was frozen.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, well, you could easily walk on the ice. People were walking across the river like during the day.
Uh-huh.
But obviously that's not what he ended up doing.
Right.
But yeah, it quickly became obvious to us that only like two floors of this hotel were occupied. I mean, the rest of it was just empty.
Sure, of course.
And when we were going up in the elevator, we'd sometimes would stop at a random floor. The doors would open, and since it was winter, like it was just pitch black in the whole floor, and this giant gust of cold air would just rush in. We'd go, "Oh man,
oh my gosh, yeah,
yeah." And once actually, because there's like four elevators in this hotel, and only one of them was running at the time. And we were up on like the 37th floor, and we had a giant group and like 20 people or whatever. And so once we got back from a really long day, we were all exhausted, just wanted to like go relax in our rooms. And we just squeezed as many people as possible onto the elevator. And that was a bad idea. We went up like 8 floors or something, and all of a sudden, just stopped. And this buzzer went off like,
oh my God.
Like, oh my God, what's going on?
Yeah.
People were freaking out, like, we're going to die. And someone got on the phone. It's like, please help.
That's
please.
Wild.
Yeah. And eventually the doors opened. But it was one of these unoccupied floors, just pitch black. And we're like, fuck.
Shit.
Someone's got to get out.
Yeah.
Like, we're weighing this thing down.
Right.
Who's volunteering to get out of this thing? Like, walk around there. So like a handful of people got off. I stayed on. I'm like, I'm not getting off this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild. The closest thing I've been to North Korea is actually on the China-North Korea border.
Dandong?
Exactly. Yeah. Have you been there?
Yeah. Yeah. Afterwards we went there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you went to the section of the Great Wall where you can like look out.
Yeah, dude, that was crazy.
That's so wild. And did you take a boat also?
Yeah. Now, the boats, you can take a boat all the way to the shore, I think, normally, the North Korean shore.
Yeah.
There was a lot of ice still.
Oh.
So we only
you did
went
this
about,
right after this trip.
Yeah, immediately. Because we still had like another week of Chinese New Year
holiday. Break, yeah.
Yep. So we went up there and just kind of got another look at North Korea.
Yeah.
Like, it was anticlimactic, because it's like, ooh, I can see North Korea.
I guess it's anticlimactic once you've been in there.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, but if you have never been in there, it's very heavy.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Yeah, we took a boat, like, out on the river, but it couldn't go that far. It could only go kind of the middle, because there was too much ice.
Right, right.
But the Great Wall was wild. It was like, I didn't realize there's some islands that are North Korean territory that are like right next to China.
Yeah, right,
like
there,
5 feet away,
with no physical barrier,
nothing
whatsoever.
No,
yeah.
And we saw these like barrack style housing.
Yeah,
like that doesn't look Chinese.
Yeah,
like, just that just seems off.
Yeah,
and it wasn't until like we got down and saw the signs that said like "Do not throw things to the North Koreans."
Right,
like,
right.
We realized, oh my God, that was North Korea.
North Korea, yeah, and, yeah. When I was there, it was in the springtime, so we were able to take the boat, the speedboat, you know, to the North Korean side.
Okay, right.
And you're basically, because the way the geography of it is, you know, there's like an inlet, and you boat around it so that the inlet that's on North Korea is to your right, but then the mainland of North Korea is to your left.
Mm.
So you're surrounded by North Korea.
Oh,
and
okay.
There were you know, there are people on the shore that are just watching you, North Koreans.
Yeah, sure.
There are, you know, some soldiers high up on guard towers just watching. There was, you know, it's intense.
Totally.
And then there were boats that are anchored in the middle of this waterway to sell goods.
Mm-hmm.
That are there, so they're selling, like, you know, liquor, ginseng root.
Mm. Chinese boats, you mean?
No, they're North Koreans. That
oh, they come up to your boat.
They're anchored, but if from China, you can take your guide will boat you up to these guys who are anchored and sell you goods.
So
So you can get like North Korean eggs. They sell North Korean eggs or North Korean kimchi, or I bought some North Korean liquor.
Yeah.
Or there's like a ginseng root with in a wooden sort of booklet thing that's like a wooden tablet that opens up and it's like a framed ginseng root, and with like the North Korean leader's face on it. And so these guys are just anchored there waiting for tourists to boat up to them and they can sell goods to them.
Huh.
And I asked. The guide had said that this is like there's some agreement between, you know, this little commune and the people, you know, here that they'll sell goods to Chinese or to foreign tourists. But there are very few foreign tourists that come actually here.
Yeah.
It's mostly Chinese.
Yeah, vast majority are Chinese.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Huh. That just, it seems like someone's either getting bribed or.
Right.
Or most of that money's going back to the government. Yeah, who knows?
The craziest thing was, though, in Dandong, I was with a very good friend of mine who I met in Beijing. She's from Dandong. She wasn't there, but she introduced me to some of her old childhood friends. So they took us out to a North Korean meal. And I don't know if when you were there, if you went to a North Korean restaurant.
I think we went. We tried to, and I think the one we saw was closed or something. But,
so we went to a North Korean restaurant, and there are, you know, ladies, women at the door greeting everyone, and they're sort of, you know, hi, welcome.
Like bored.
But when I was with a buddy, when we walked in, it was like, holy shit, foreigners are here. Welcome. God. Like, hi, welcome. They were really excited to see foreigners. Really excited. And then we were seated at a table that was close towards the kitchen or where the waitresses sort of prepared food before it was brought to the... to other guests, to other tables. And, you know, it's... everyone there is North Korean. Everyone at these North Korean restaurants are North Korean. They're from North Korea, sent over...
All of the employees.
All the employees.
Yeah.
Yeah, the people eating are from China or whatever. Yeah. But, yeah, the employees are North Korean. And so I started talking to one of the waitresses that was serving food. She was preparing food next to me. I said, started talking to her in Chinese. Because...
Mm-hmm.
These are all, you know, well-educated people that are sent over to China to work.
Oh, yes. They must speak Chinese.
They speak Chinese. Anyway. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I started talking to her, and I said, you know, hi. And I said, you know, how long have you been here? And she said, a couple years. And she asked where I was from. And I said, I looked at my friend, and I said, should I tell her? Because I was nervous about, you know, like... just saying I'm from America.
Yeah.
She was sort of friendly beforehand. So she asked where I was from. And I asked her, where do you think I'm from? And I think she said Russia or some other country.
Which would be, that's a good guess.
Right.
I mean, just based on who's going to go there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I said no. And eventually I told her I'm from America. And she immediately turned stone cold faced.
Really?
And said, I don't like Americans.
Whoa.
And immediately was like... I don't want to talk to you anymore. And then I was like, oh, come on. Like, it's okay. Like, you know, we can still talk and be friendly and stuff. And she was like, no, I don't like Americans. And I forget the exact details of what happened, but eventually I started getting nervous. And, well, then she quickly left. Yeah. And the host, the people that were taking us out, came back. They were ordering food, and they came back to the table. And I told them this story. And they said, oh, I'm sure, like, this... She's telling her boss. And, like, the whole restaurant's now going to know that there are two Americans in this restaurant.
Yeah.
So they were, like... They were nervous as, like, Chinese-friendly people who are taking their guests out to a dinner.
Yeah.
and who were very well aware of like the tension between North Korea and this city. Apparently, there have been kidnappings from North Koreans. North Koreans have been kidnapping people and taking them across the border.
Really?
At times. This has happened before. So they were nervous about. They had warned us beforehand: don't be fraternizing too much with strangers.
Yeah.
You just don't know where they're from. Yeah. So they were nervous now that the restaurant sort of had eyes on us because there were Americans at the table. Then one of the waitress came back, and the Chinese friend, one of the hosts that had been taking us around, said, "Hey, I heard you were unfriendly to my American friend." And she said, "No, it's okay. He's a guest, so it's okay. Like, he's a guest at the restaurant, it's okay." Mm. And then he said, the friend said, "No, actually, you should just treat everyone nice. It shouldn't matter whether they're a guest or not. You should just treat everyone nice." And she's like, "Okay." And then she just walked away. It was super tense.
Yeah.
You could just feel the tension there.
Yeah, totally, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Exactly. You don't know. And then, you know, the food came out, it was fine, but then there's a whole music performance.
Of course, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's, you know, like a 5-piece band, and I could not tell if they were actually playing music or, like, lip-syncing with musical instruments.
Really?
Like, the music. Because it was clear there was music playing in the background. It wasn't just all from their instruments.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't tell, like, I could see the drummer just sort of doing motions without, it was very hard to tell if the sound was coming from her drum kit or from the music in the background. And that was sort of the case with all the instruments. It was very bizarre.
It's a bit of a metaphor for North Korea itself.
But it was just a very interesting night.
Yeah,
with all these, you know, the interactions, and their general attitude towards Chinese versus their attitude towards foreigners, then their attitude towards Americans, which is very interesting.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating place.
It's an interesting place.
And situation that exists in this modern world.
Right.
Like, how does this even happen?
Right.
But, yeah, wow. I haven't even, like, you know, when I got back from North Korea, I just wrote down everything I remembered.
Sure.
I didn't even take, like, I was so freaked out. I didn't even take a pen or anything into the country.
Yeah.
Didn't bring my laptop in. Like, you're allowed to bring a laptop now.
You are.
Yeah, they might check it, but for, like, anything bad that
I mean, you took pictures and they didn't.
I brought a camera.
Did they go through your pictures?
No, not at all.
Yeah,
and I was a little nervous about that, but no, nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And most people brought their phones. You can bring phones now. I did not bring one just because I was nervous again.
Yeah, and what would you use it for? I mean,
well, for pictures.
Sure. For pictures, yeah. But you're not. You can make phone calls from there.
No. But actually, if you get a SIM card now, you can.
You get a North Korean SIM card?
Yeah. Yeah. Only a few select people can get one, like the tour guides.
Right.
Which, like, for practical reasons. Like,
of course, safety. Yeah. Or medical reasons, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a tour guide, like, you might need to contact your company in Beijing and, like, there's no way to do that.
Or, like, if you need normally. To go to the hospital for whatever reason.
Or know? That. Yeah. Sure. I think what happened. I might get this slightly off, but you know the big pyramid hotel that I referred to earlier? That just kind of sat there unfinished for like 20-something years.
Right.
And it was voted like the ugliest building in the world at one point. It's just like this concrete giant thing with just like the exterior wasn't even done. And so the Egyptian government came in and said, "Hey, we'll build you a pyramid."
Of course.
So they finished the outside, and I think it looks really cool now. It's like this blue color.
Huh.
I'll put up a picture on the show notes of this podcast.
Sure.
In exchange for doing that, I guess they were able to put up like some cell phone towers in North Korea.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so now there's like 3G connections to the outside world, but absolutely forbidden for like just about everybody in the country. But like I said, just for the foreigners who are leading tours. Here and there, they're able to get online.
Interesting.
But even for the people in our group, their phones were only for, like, taking pictures or playing games or whatever. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people rode the train in, too, through Dandong.
Through Dandong, yeah, sure.
Yeah, they will not let Americans do that for some random reason. Every other nationality is allowed to.
But really?
That was really the only restriction we faced for being American.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was... Just fascinating trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know my parents will kill me if I go there. That's the one country in the world there they really don't want me to go to.
Yeah, yeah.
So I might stay away from
it. And that's understandable.
Exactly, yeah.
But yeah, or just go and just don't, like we were saying, don't tell them until after.
I know. I'm nervous about doing that one.
Yeah.
I've done that with bungee jumping. I've done that with, you know, crazy road trips, like getting stuck in a desert. You know, like really life-threatening stuff I've done before, but that's one where I might not pull the trigger on.
Yeah.
And not tell them about.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Maybe once they reunify, you can check
exactly
it out. If that ever happens.
If that ever happens, right.
Who knows? One thing I learned that's really interesting is both sides, in theory, want reunification, but they just have different ideas about what it looks like.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're not really compatible. So
yeah,
we'll see.
We'll see.
Katie and I have also gone to South Korea, and it's like so totally different.
Oh yeah,
yet similar in some ways.
Yeah,
you've been there too.
Yeah, yeah, I've been to. I've seen North Korea from the Korean side at the DMZ, then seen it from Dandong. Just haven't been in the actual country.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, South Korea is a great country.
It's cool.
Yeah, it's very advanced and modern and great food and, you know, friendly. I think it's friendly, but...
Oh, very much.
But...
very safe country.
Yeah.
Like, my first experience there, I was buying a subway ticket, and it didn't give me my change back, and I couldn't figure out why. The machine wasn't giving me change. I mean, I'd only been in the country for 10 minutes.
Right.
And I was like, whatever. It's just like, I forget how much, like a dollar or something.
Sure.
Whatever, I'll just screw it. So I walked away, and this guy just ran up behind me. He's like, sir, hey, stop. And I'm like, wait, did I do something wrong? I'm like getting arrested or something already? He's like, you forgot your money. And he handed me my money back.
Aw,
that's
like, nice.
Holy shit, like, that's super honest. Like, there's no way I would have even had any... There's like, he could have so easily just kept it.
Right, right.
But yeah, very, very honest people.
Yeah.
It was a good trip.
Nice.
Let's see, how long have we been going for? Over an hour already. Huh, that just flew by.
Got any other questions?
Dude, yeah. We should just wrap it up right now.
Okay.
You know, you'll be in and out of Beijing in the next few months.
Yeah, I'll be heading to Thailand tomorrow, and then I will be back in Beijing the week after, and
I'm going to be out till like February, I think. Katie has Christmas break for 2 weeks, and then like 3 weeks back in Beijing, and then Chinese New Year for 2 weeks. So we're gonna just go to Yunnan for like together. She's gonna come back for 3 weeks. I'll stay in Yunnan and check it out. And
sure,
I'm sure I'll find something to do.
I'm sure you will.
I think that'll work better than coming back to Beijing just for a couple weeks.
Yeah, nice.
And then she'll come meet me again. So then that puts me out of Beijing till February.
Got it.
Yeah. But, if you want to continue this discussion, like, later, like, next year, maybe.
Absolutely, yeah. 2017. Yeah,
it's been awesome.
Cool, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Really good stories.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.